Welcome to part two of our interview with Bob Long of Montagna Napa Valley. I think the wine business is highs and lows because you're dealing with your own business, the finance, you're dealing with the weather, you're dealing with all, there's so many aspects.
It's not a widget.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely not a widget. So how did you evolve into Montagna then?
Okay, so we had this property. In 1985, the brothers subdivided the property into 40-acre parcels. So we ended up with 14, 15 parcels. The boys went out to lunch, and at the end of the lunch, we divided the parcels, and that was it. And so I like the western side of our estate, and so the parcels I have go all the way down from Sage Canyon Road right down the lake all the way up on this side, and you know what, I wanted my own winery, but at the same time all you had to do is watch the county, and we Napa County is great. At the same time, there the pattern was a continuing concentration on efforts to protect the land, and as a result, certain zoning issues and erosion control issues and parcel size and things like that, that were going to complicate matters if I ever wanted to build a winery myself. So in 1999, 2000, did a deal with Dave. At that time, I had this 1987 911, and I traded that 911 to Dave to put in the Montagna Vineyard.
That's perfect.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you don't have cash, but you have things.
You got something, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Well, that's not a... I think you both probably did okay on that deal, I think.
He's still driving it.
Does he really?
Oh,
cool.
Sure. Yeah. No, still running.
Yeah.
I can't take it back. I wish I could.
Well, then you'd have to get the
property
back.
So we started that, and you know, with the focused on Cab, the traditional blends, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot. Later, I put in a little Malbec. I did a little Syrah. I make 68 cases of Syrah this last year, and started in on it. And I made a little wine in 03, 04, 05. First release was 6, and first major release was 7. And by the time I was making this wine, Bob Egelhoff made it up to 5 or 6, and Niles Ackerley took over after that. With the advent of people like, well, certainly David Arthur, but then you had Ovid come in, and you have Ann Colgan come in, and Joe Winder, and the bar started becoming, from my perspective, pretty darn high, and the expectation was, you know, you better be making this wine. So I'm my worst critic, and if it didn't hit the bar, I wasn't going to do it. So I didn't release an 03, I didn't release an 04, I didn't release an 05.
Wow.
I got audited by the Internal Revenue Service in 06 because they said, this is a hobby. And so I took a bottle of wine to a hearing at the Internal Revenue Service, and I said, here's our deal. We've been making wine at David Arthur for 35 years, okay? The bar for us, and I use those terms, I said, the bar for us is so high here. If it's not making, it's not in my best interest to release it, okay? I don't know what he did with this bottle of wine, but I will tell you that 4 months later, we got the whole thing reversed, and it was completely canceled.
Not that we're referring or recommending or anything.
No, I don't know what he did with that bottle of wine.
It was probably tested, I imagine.
Yeah, sent to the lab.
The label was examined very clearly. Right.
Right. Right.
But that also shows what it is, what a challenge it is to be in this business when you've got these kind of neighbors, and B, just the people in the business you're with in general. You really have to be able to make something you're going to stand behind. And again, you know, the name is on it, your name, it's what you represent. The property here, let's talk about this in terms of how many acres you have here you're farming right now.
I'm farming 14 acres right now, and I just planted another 18. So that parcel 3 that we planted for David Arthur, in 1997, we pulled it out because of phylloxera. It was 2007.
So yeah, and I'd heard Phylloxera took a longer time to get into the mountains.
Yeah, it took a longer time to get up to the hills, and we pulled it out, and we let it go fallow for about 3 or 4 years. And then I started the plan of replanting it. And so I've just finished it this year. Yeah, so it's been some time. But we had to rip it. When you drove down to this house, Did you see the rock on the other side? Did you see that rock mountain?
That pile, yes. Yeah. We were talking about that,
okay,
too.
That was the second time we ripped that field.
So that's what came out of it.
That came out the second time.
You know, again, one more time for our listeners to get the idea. That pile was probably, what, 30 feet high, give or take, maybe even more?
That pile goes down about 150 feet. You're seeing the top 30 feet.
That's a ditch.
I filled in a ravine.
Wow. That's an amazing amount of rock.
Yeah. You're going to see these guys that are 6 by 6 by 8 that instead of dynamiting, I moved off thinking sometime someone is going to want those because you can lift them up and you can truck them, and they're just really beautiful. Otherwise, you know, they just go in the pile.
So moving forward, we're here in 2013 following this incredible growing season of 2012. Let's talk a little bit about that. We were talking in the cave about it, and this was kind of a winemaker's dream come true, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of a feast or famine kind of thing because you had 10 and 11 that were very challenging. You had, in 2011, I think my production was down by 38%, something like that. And then 2012, it was increased by 150%. Or more, 175%. I go from 1,200 cases to 2,400 cases, so double. All right.
I always like to, again, tell our listeners, imagine going home with 38% of your paycheck less. Of course, on the other hand, it's nice when you have that percentage above it.
Yeah.
So you did actually increase your production, is that right? Or did you sell the fruit? Or
No. What we don't sell any fruit. What we'll do is we'll sell juice. So the plan is we've got everything in barrels, and now we go through it, and we decide what we're going to bottle, and we'll bulk out. My guess is a good 15% of that will go someplace, and that's not atypical for what we do anyway.
No, obviously because of the year you had. So there's kind of a question I've never asked anybody. What is the difference for you as an owner to be able to sell fruit versus juice? Is it a control thing, knowing that the juice is quality?
The idea is that until you have made wine, you don't know how good it is. And I don't want to start selling fruit unless I can't tell how good it's going to be. So we get everything in barrels, we get everything in wine, and then we do these tastings. And we say, okay, this is not making the cut, or this is going to do it. And I much rather do that. It's a little bit more laborious, but I'd much rather do that than to sell fruit.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And when you're selling fruit, you always have the person that's purchasing it in your field telling you what to prune, how to canopy management, irrigation, whole thing. I'm not dealing with that.
Right. As you approach this, I mean, you don't have a crystal ball. You don't know it's going to be that kind of a season. You don't really know what your production is going to be till you get towards the end of the season.
We knew 2012 was going to be big only because of the size of the clusters. Were monsters.
So there was a tip off then.
Yeah.
So that'd make you feel pretty good. And what are you thinking, when would an average person like me be able to buy a bottle from you of the 12? When does that see daylight after aging and in the bottle and everything else?
Oh, we're probably talking 2 years.
Okay, which is a fair amount of time.
Yeah.
Cool. How would you compare it to 2007, which everybody was all crazy about? Seems to be 12 was the biggie, but you tell me.
You know what? It's, once again, I think it's too early to call. It tastes great. It's our classic. It's what you dream of in a wine, especially for Pritchard Hill. I think it speaks all about Pritchard Hill, and it's going to reinforce, you know, our image of what we produce. Time will tell. You know, I people are on the fence on 97s. We've pulled corks on our elevation, and it's still rocking. The other night, I was talking to someone, and they thought, you know, maybe the 97s were a little bit overrated. I don't think so. I think it's winery specific.
I would agree. I agree that with that solely. That's why the whole idea of how people judge the vintage could be skewed.
Yeah, yeah. A lot to do with how you made that wine, mm-hmm. you know, and then everything else corks.
So Niles Ackerley is your winemaker, and he's been with you for a little while here.
About almost 6 years.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how you work with him. And is it very much a team effort as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, well, he makes it a team effort. He's involved from the Montagna side of things at pretty much all levels. I mean, I bring him in on marketing from the standpoint of evaluating wines and what we want to do and where certain wines should go, because he's got some experience and he has a very good palate for wines. He is a great team player. I would say that Niall, his commitment to excellence is in line with ours. And I see Niall in the field more than I see him in the winery. And I think a lot of people talk about where you make wine. If you have to make wine in the winery, you have that kind of wine. And from really canopy management to irrigation, and I joke sometimes, I told this joke the other day, I said, in the good old days, we're talking about irrigation, would turn on the water, go have lunch, forget that it was on, and then turn it off at dinner. those days are
whoops.
Over.
Yes.
Yeah, whoops, whatever. You know, loosey-goosey.
But you really say, it's this commitment to perfection.
Yeah, right. Drop in fruit, the whole thing. I look at this business, and in my other business for 35 years was in the shopping center management development world, okay, where everything was, not everything, but things were much more definite. You bought a piece of property, you knew your cost. You built this property, you did your marketing thing, you knew what the market was, you knew what the retailer, and you could kind of anticipate business. You have a vineyard, and Mother Nature is your partner all the way until it's done.
For
right?
good or for bad.
Good. There's no controlling that.
Right.
And then it's a luck of the draw in making wine. You can eliminate a lot of the stuff in winemaking, obviously, but you can't eliminate the stuff out there. It's 2011, 2012. Right.
Two completely different planets.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Bob, if our listeners would like to learn a little bit more about Montagna and learn about Bob Long, how would they do that online?
Best thing to do is go to our site, MontagnaNapaValley.com.
Great. Thank you very much.
You know, it's been a pleasure having you here.
Well,
really,
it's very kind of you.
I love it.
Great.
We should take a walk around here.
I would love to.
Okay.
To download, go to LifeBetweenTheVines.com or visit iTunes.
Thanks for listening, and tune in for our next podcast featuring President and CEO of Duckhorn Wines, Alex Ryan. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Our intern is Ray Spears. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2013.